From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Larry Tye returns to From the Bookshelf this week. He was here last when he published his biography of Satchel Paige. His latest book is a biography of another all-American hero. It's called Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Larry Tye, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Good to be back with you.
Larry Tye, this book, Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, it's really about every aspect of Superman, including what goes on in the comics. Do you read a lot of comics?
I did read a lot of comics when I was 10 years old, and this book made me feel for the last 2 years like I was 10 years old again. And I have read more in the last 2 years. I've read more comics than any human being alive, I think. So made up for what I haven't done.
Well, as you point out in your book, the average reader of comic books, which would include me, I suppose, is no longer 9 years old.
That's true. The average reader of comic books can't afford to be 9 years old because comic books cost somewhere between $2.99 and $3.99 an issue, and they tend to be more in their 20s and tend to be wealthier and tend to be more serious, and so that makes for a different kind of comic book character, and it also makes for a challenge with fewer people reading the comic books. When Warner Brothers comes along the way they did this summer and releases an animated Superman film, and the way they intend to next summer, producing what they hope will be the biggest Superman film ever, The Man of Steel, it makes it a challenge to try to tap into memories that people have of Superman when not as many people are following him on a week-by-week basis.
Well, you know, I think one of the problems with all of the superhero movies, and you talk about several of them in your book, is that the people who make the movies, pardon me, are not the same people who write the comic books. And I guess because a comic book has to sell a couple of 100,000 copies and a movie has to appeal to millions and millions of people. But sometimes it seems to me if they would stick a little closer to the comic books, they would be able to make a better movie.
That's true, and that's why in the old days, and it's unclear whether it will continue to be true with next summer's movie, in the old days, DC Comics had people on the set of the movie with veto power. That if they felt the movie wasn't being true to the character, if it was being too camp or too dark or anything that deviated from the Superman mythos, they had the power to come in and say, you're doing it wrong. And whether or not they still carry that kind of veto, we will see. And if they don't, and if they get it wrong, they may make a lot of money at the movies, but they'll also take, in this internet era of instantaneous feedback, they will take lots of heat. That in the course of the Batman movie that's out there now, they have run a 30-second Superman trailer. And even with that short trailer, which doesn't say much, people are already starting to weigh in.
They're already pissed off.
They already are pissed off, exactly. And I think it's a sign, and they've got to be smart enough at Warner Brothers to know that they've got to be careful.
Well, what do you know about the new movie?
What I know about it is that I know very little about the plot on it. I know that they've hoped that this guy that is playing Superman, this British actor named Henry Cavill, is a Christopher Reeve, the kind of star of a movie, superhero movie like Christopher Reeve was, where he could appear in four successive movies. The last time we saw Superman on the big screen was in 2006 with Superman Returns, and Brandon Routh, while I thought he did pretty well, in fact lasted for a grand total of one movie. The movie didn't make the money that they had hoped it would. He didn't set up a new franchise the way they hoped, and they really hope that they've got it down right now with this new guy. They also hope, and this is really critical, if we don't want this to be the last Superman movie ever, then something has to happen in terms of a settlement of the lawsuit that the creators of Superman's heirs have brought against DC Comics and Time Warner. And this lawsuit, which is being decided in California, at the early stages of it, it looks like the decision is coming down in a way that certain of Superman's attributes will go to the heirs, that the uniform that he wears and powers to jump high and run fast, because those were there at the very beginning, and other attributes that didn't come along until later when those creators were clearly working as contract employees for DC Comics, like the ability to fly, would go to DC Comics and Time Warner. And we need a judge with the wisdom of Solomon who understands that if you tear the baby apart, you don't have a character left. And I think that if we want Warner Brothers to keep producing movies, it's got to know that it owns the rights to this character. And I think the heirs to the creators have got to know that they've got a fair settlement. And I think there's clear grounds for everybody walking away happy and rich. But unless they do, Superman's future is threatened.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the creators, but obviously your book, Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, must have had at least the blessing of Warner Brothers, because you were able to use images of Superman comics in your book.
It had the cooperation, to an extent, of everybody involved in the dispute and of everybody involved in the history, but it didn't have, as a lifelong journalist, I never asked for any official blessing, because I didn't want anybody to see the book before it came out and be able to in any way censor the book or censor anything I said or question anything I said. So Warner Brothers and Time Warner were wonderfully cooperative in selling us the rights at a rate that we could afford it to have those pictures in there, but they didn't see, and neither did the creator's heirs, any of this before it came out. It's a really tender line, and you as a journalist can understand that that it's really sensitive in terms of wanting the people that you owe something to are your readers, and what you owe them is an honesty that's trying to tell as objective a story as you can, not tarnished by anybody giving you anything.
Well, you do kind of walk a line when you talk about the creators of Superman, and they were Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, both now passed away, but it's interesting because on the one hand, those guys obviously got screwed. I mean, lots and lots of people were making lots of money, and they were the guys who created Superman, and therefore they should have had, even though they did get paid a tremendous amount of money, they didn't get paid anywhere near the amount of money that DC Comics made over the years on the character, especially when the movies came along. On the other hand, you point out that Siegel and Shuster created Superman by looking at other things that had already been created. So how original was Superman to begin with?
Yes, if the world were as litigious as Jerry and Joe and Time Warner became over the years, then the creators of the Samson story and the Hercules story and the Doc Savage and Phantom and all of these other things, these wonderful stories of mythic superheroes that Jerry and Joe built on, they would have been suing Jerry and Joe. And I think that everybody borrows from everybody else. I do call what happened to Jerry and Joe that they sold the rights to their character, not just the rights to that first comic book story, but the rights in perpetuity for a grand total split between the two of them of $130. And to me, that's the original sin of comic books. On the other hand, they were so desperate to get the story published after 5 years of trying and failing, they would have sold it for 50 cents. And they did become famous, they did become relatively rich, and their story made it out there in a way that they had never dreamed possible. Should they have shared in the billions that Superman made? Yes. Did they get more than they had ever bargained for, these two unknown teenagers from a poor part of Cleveland, Ohio? They became famous, and we're talking about them here 75 years later, which is not a bad thing.
And, you know, they did create, I think it's fair to say that Superman is the greatest fictional character ever created. And I think the proof of that is the fact that all these years later, not a month has gone by in which there hasn't been at least four or five Superman stories told.
I think you're exactly right. There are only two popular culture figures in the world that are recognizable across the world, and one of them is Mickey Mouse, and the other, to me, more elegant and towering one, is the Man of Steel, Superman.
Yeah, yeah. I loved your book, Larry Tye, because you'd also talk about Superman as a character, what all transpired in Superman and how the legend has grown over the years. And like we were saying earlier, that must have been some fun research of reading thousands of comic books over the last couple of years, huh?
It was a blast, reading thousands of comic books, watching endless old TV shows, watching the movies over and over again, and more importantly, trying to understand what Superman, what it said about him and about us, that 74 years and counting, he is still a soaring character.
And what are some of those things? What does Superman say about us?
Well, so I think the key to the Superman stories being successful is several things. One is it's that he evolved over the years more than the fruit fly. He gave us in every era the hero that we needed. So in the 1930s, that was the consummate New Deal liberal. At a time when we were mired in a Great Depression, he was out there taking on slum lords and wife beaters, and he was the FDR liberal. In the war years, he helped lead us into the war. He went and brought back Stalin and Hitler by the scruff of their necks in an early comic book long before America had gone to war. And during the war years, the government used him to sell war bonds and to send comic books off to troops to teach them everything from how to read to remind them what they were fighting for back home. In the 50s, he took on the Red Menace when that was what we were worried about. In every era, he adjusted to give us something special, particular to that era. That was a piece of it. A piece of it is just his story itself. He was the same way that Little Orphan Annie is a compelling story of an orphan. What more compelling orphan could we have than one who came from another planet, who was a true alien in our midst? He gave us a romance, a love triangle that only had two people actually involved with it, and the guy who would never get the girl, the guy who didn't want to get the girl, and the girl who was torn between the two guys. The maybe most importantly, though, the one thing that Superman gave us that was different from the dark hero of Batman and from the fraught hero of Spider-Man was the clearest sense that we've ever had in a superhero of right and wrong. Superman knew instinctually just what to do, and he was always doing the right thing. And for all that that seems clunky and like a Dudley Do-Right character, that's something that's also reassuring, and that's why we keep going back to him, I think.
The American way. I mean, that was a phrase, I guess, that Superman created.
He did, and it came in during the war years, and it was something, as we were trying to figure out what it was we were fighting for something for sort of global and generalizable values like truth and justice, but there was also something wonderfully and peculiarly American about those values. It was America in our most idealistic, and I think that that's what Superman, while people have talked, particularly in recent years, about him being a global hero and a citizen of the world, he also represents something distinctively American, and America at our best, the same way that people take to the streets in Egypt or in Moscow or wherever and look to American democracy as an inspiration. They also look to Superman.
And, of course, Superman was the very first comic book character, and then he was the first comic book character to have a secret identity and wear a cape, and he was the first comic book character to appear on screen as a cartoon and a serial and then later a television series and all those things. The Superman that exists on all of those levels is, I mean, there's slightly different Supermans, I guess. And there's also this tendency of undoing the things that have happened.
It's true, and it's wonderful. The great thing about comic books and fantasy is you can get him married one day and have him forget that he was ever married the next day. And he was also as distinct from just about every other major comic book hero who's out there, as distinct from Batman or Spider-Man, for instance. With Batman, the real character was Bruce Wayne. With Spider-Man, it was Peter Parker. With Superman, the real character is Superman, and the disguise is Clark Kent. And I think that means something kind of profound. And what it means to me is that this is a guy who didn't need to wear a mask or a disguise. He was who he was, and he was willing to show his face and show his true identity to the world. And yet, as an alien who came from Krypton, he was trying to relate to these strange beings called humans. And one of the ways of relating was disguising himself and trying to get by as one of us. And it wasn't just that the guise of being a reporter let him be there where the action was. It also let him be there where the humans were and try to really understand and relate to Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen and everybody else.
There have been a lot of jokes about the fact that nobody can recognize Clark Kent because he's wearing glasses. In fact, you even published in your book the cover of one of my favorite Lois Lane comics in which Superman Clark Kent is tearing off his glasses and looking at Lana and Lois and saying, I'm never going to marry either of you because you're too stupid to see that I'm Superman when I take my brother. but I also think that occasionally it's been explained in the comic books and in the films, you know, well, if you're flying really fast and you're wearing a skin-tight costume, who's going to really see your face as well as if they were looking into Clark Kent's face?
It's been explained that way. It's been explained at one point in the 1960s, I think it was, when they called him the great mesmerizer from Metropolis. It was that his glasses were somehow casting a hypnotic spell on everybody who looked at him, so they couldn't see what he really looked like. I think a lot of it's explained by just lousy acting. I love George Reeves was wonderful in the 1950s TV series, but he never changed the cadence of his voice. He never changed the way he carried himself. Christopher Reeve, a generation later, at least slouched and parted his hair on different sides when he was Clark and Superman. George Reeves put on or took off his glasses and his uniform, and that was as far as he could go. And yet, 10-year-olds like me wanted to believe it so badly that we were willing to put up with that lack of differentiation between them. We were willing to put up with the fact that I loved the idea, as I go back and watch these things now, that Superman would have bullets bounce off him when George Reeve was playing him, and yet when the robbers got tired of shooting at him and seeing the bullets bounce off, they'd throw the gun at him and he would duck.
Well, because that would actually hit him. It would hurt, you know.
But, yeah.
You know, one of the things I love about watching those George Reeves shows, which, of course, I grew up with also. In fact, I think it's the thing that's wrong with superhero movies and also James Bond movies now, is that the superheroes or James Bond or whatever are always trying to save the world. It's always the world is at stake every time, which, you know, gets a little old. Whereas on those shows, you know, he was trying to foil a jewel robber.
Exactly. It was, I think that the more he stuck to things that were human scale, the more believable and the more we could all relate to it. And it goes back to the very first story that Joe ever drew that Jerry had dreamed up. And it was a story that was real to Jerry. It was a story that it showed in the drawing Superman going in and saving a man who was being robbed. And what had happened not long before that to Jerry's dad is he owned a used clothing store in a seedy side of Cleveland, Ohio. And one day, three guys came in and robbed him. They walked out with a suit and didn't pay. And Michael Siegel, Jerry's dad, had a massive heart attack and died basically on the spot. And this was a bereft kid who was trying to dream up a story where his hero, or he in the guise of his hero, came in and saved a guy who looked a whole lot like Michael Siegel in Joe Shuster's drawing. And I think that these stories were really all about what kids, Jerry and Joe, could envision in their own lives, and that's why you and I believe them, because they were somebody like us dreaming them up.
We're talking with Larry Tai, and his new book is called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. And Larry Tai has also written lots of other things, including that wonderful biography of the pitcher Satchel Paige, which was not only a great book about Satchel, but a great book about the whole Negro Leagues and that whole scene. And we did an interview about that. You can find on our website, fromthebookshelf.com. But I want to ask you about the aspect of Superman that you spend some time talking about in the book, and that is the religious aspect. There's a great scene in Superman 2 when Superman is saving a little boy from Niagara Falls, and you can hear a woman say, "Of course he's Jewish."
It's a wonderful scene, and so I think just about every religion out there has claimed Superman is theirs. Christians see the Superman story as the metaphoric Christ story, that God sends his only son to earth to save mankind, to show them that they can be better than they thought they could be. Buddhists think of Superman as the ultimate Zen-like character. Atheists and agnostics say, why do we need any religion? He's the perfect secular messiah. But I think the real evidence out there is that Superman is, as that old lady said in the movie, that he is Jewish. And he's Jewish because Jerry and Joe named him when he was on the planet Krypton, Kal-El, which in Hebrew means the all-embracing God or the vessel of God. He is Jewish because what better story is there from the Bible than the story of parents trying to save their son, in this case by floating him out in space rather than on a river, and two Gentiles named Martha and John Kent adopt him and raise him as theirs, realizing they've got an extraordinary kid. And if that's not Moses and Exodus, then I don't know what is. But my favorite piece of evidence is that any name that ends in the word M-A-N is either a superhero or a Jew, or in this case, both.
And in the first action comic, isn't the woman who finds him named Mary?
Absolutely. And the names of the characters shifted a whole lot in the early years. Each new set of writers who came in and each new format that Superman appeared under, the name seemed to shift. So sometimes it was John Kent, and at one point it was Eben Kent, and it was Sarah or Martha or Mary, and the names changed until they finally settled in. And every medium, radio and TV, the comics and the comic books and the comic strips finally agreed on certain common names and certain backstory. But in the beginning, it was filling in. It wasn't like the Tolkien story where the whole thing there, you get an entire universe in your first look at it. In this one, we had a mini-universe, and Jerry and Joe and their successors gave us the pieces we needed as they went along.
And as the story kind of grew over the first 30 years of Superman, he was at first the last survivor of Krypton, but then it turned out there were other survivors, including a super dog and a super horse and a super monkey and a super girl and a bottled city of Kandor. And after a while, it seemed like the only people who didn't survive the explosion of Krypton were Jor-El and Lara.
Yeah, it's true. And the wonderful thing is that they filled in things like that, and they would go to certain extremes. There were so many survivors, as you say, that it got to be a little crazy, and so they could take him away. And when Superman got too many powers, he would have powers to, at the beginning, lift boulders, and at some point in the 1960s, he was lifting planets. And when it got too powerful, they depowered him. This was fantasy, and we could do whatever we wanted with it. And as long as they didn't tinker with the basics of it to the point where they would turn off loyal fans, they could get away with just about anything.
Well, I was thinking that, I was surprised when I read in your book the opposite is true, but I was thinking that probably during the big comic book scare that was launched by Frederick Wertheim in his book Seduction of the Innocent, that Superman would have been immune from that, but apparently not.
He should have been immune because he was as clean-cut a comic book hero as they could find. The PTA and Wertheim and various clergymen were upset about the violence in the comic books, and they felt that was polluting the minds of young readers. But they actually destroyed their own credibility rather than enhancing it by taking on Superman. If there was ever a character and a romance that was de-sexed, it was Superman's relationship with Lois Lane, and yet they went after that. They went after his violence, when in fact Superman, to the frustration of many readers, would never kill anyone, and he would always bring guys like Lex Luthor to be locked up at the end of one comic book, when you knew at the beginning of the next they would have escaped from that jail and nobody could hold them. But Superman did that because that was the moral code that he lived by, and yet the one group that didn't seem to be able to buy into his moral code were these censors, and he outlasted them.
Yeah, absolutely. And now, in 2012, there's a new Superman. That is, DC has restarted both Action Comics and Superman with number ones, and they have new writers. And what's going on with Superman now? Have you been keeping up?
I have been. But honestly, I think that what they're trying to do is really interesting. They're trying to have a commercial rebirth. There are new people actually in charge at DC Comics. Paul Levitz, the guy who ran it at one level or another for 20, 25 years, is gone, and there's somebody new who's in charge of DC Entertainment and lots of new writers and others in, and they're giving him a new, more global look and trying to, on the one hand, have him rediscover his roots and You know, he walked America and tried to reconnect with people, and yet everybody knows that this is a holding pattern, that what will really determine whether Superman gets the blast into the new era and a new generation of kids, as well as holding on to their parents and their grandparents, is next summer's film. And that's sort of everything. This Man of Steel thing is the real shot at reinventing Superman in a way that he resonates. Every era has needed a little bit of reinvention, and we got it with a TV series in the 50s. We got it with the Christopher Reeves movies in the 70s. In the 90s, we got it with the death of Superman and the rebirth of Superman comic books, which sold 6 million copies more than anything ever. And now I think in this era, it's about whether Christopher Nolan, who's been involved with this Batman trilogy that just ended, he is one of the producers involved in this new Man of Steel series, and whether he and the other smart people who they're bringing in can really give us a character that we can believe in. And I think the character is there. It's just a question of whether they can give him an incarnation that is as creative as the people have done over the last 75 years with him. And it is coming out in the month that he will turn 75. Next June.
So, in other words, where Superman once was a comic book character who branched out into other media, now the comic book is a very small part of who he is.
It is. It's an important part of who he is, because that's really the most loyal fans and the ones who really keep it alive, and some of the most creative writers are involved with that. But for him to truly make money and for him to justify, to get the attention of an enormous media company like Time Warner, he's got to go out there and have a $1 billion movie. And this is a movie, make no mistake, that they intend to surpass their Batman movie. Batman in the first week set a record, I think number two of all times in the first week. And Superman, by all rights, should be number one if they come out with a movie that is worthy of the character.
Do you know if the new Superman, the Man of Steel, will be wearing a red, yellow, and blue costume?
It sure looks like it in the trailer that I just saw in the Batman movie, but that depends partly on what happens with this lawsuit and whether the red, yellow, and blue costume is something that Warner Brothers owns or that they license the rights to from the heirs if they own them then. I'm really praying that between now and then, there are a lot of lawyers who are going to be making a lot of money, and I hope that they can figure out a way to make this settlement work.
Well, folks, to hold you over, I suggest that you read Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero by my guest, Larry Tye. Larry Tye, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
It was terrific to be with you. I really appreciate you having me on again.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. Check out our podcast page. It's www.fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, absolutely free, and check us out on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Larry Tye. His book is called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. I'll see you all next time. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro.